Blackstone Audiobooks presents Stein on Writing by Saul Stein. Preface. Some years ago, I addressed the Southern California chapter of the National Writers Club on a day when a rowboat might have been more appropriate than a car for getting to the meeting. The torrential rain seemed determined to widen the Pacific Ocean at the expense of a state that was once described to me as mostly desert. I managed the few hundred feet between the parking lot and the hotel without drowning. Once inside, I expected to find the meeting room deserted. Instead, I happily discovered a full house. 88 professional non-fiction writers and journalists come to hear me talk about fiction. I asked these weatherproof stalwarts, "How many of you want to write the great American novel?" And 88 hands shot up. If there are writers in America who do not have several hundred pages of a would-be novel in a drawer, or at least in mind, I have not met them. Conversely, every novelist I've known has occasion to write non-fiction. For those writers who, at least initially, want to read only about fiction or non-fiction, I offer a roadmap to this book. The contents page provides an overview of the main subjects covered. Part 1, The Essentials, is for all writers. Part 2 concerns the craft of fiction. Eavesdropping by non-fiction writers is permitted. Part 3 deals with subjects of interest to all writers. Part 4 deals mainly with the application of fictional techniques to the enhancement of nonfiction. Part 5, Literary Values, deals with upscale writing, both fiction and nonfiction. Part 6, Revision, has separate chapters for fiction and nonfiction. Part 7 contains a chapter on where to get help, a final word, and a glossary of terms used by writers and editors. The reader will find that I frequently use examples from writers I have known or worked with because their material is familiar to me. From time to time, I also quote from my own work, allegedly for copyright reasons and convenience, but perhaps also to underscore that I practice what I teach. If I quote often from the New York Times, it is convenience as well as merit that guides me. It is the newspaper I read every day. The Times has also been in the vanguard of publications using the techniques of fiction to enhance journalism. Women usually outnumber men among my students, readers, and friends, and I trust they will forgive me for using a male pronoun to stand for both genders. Saying he or she repeatedly is a distraction to both writer and reader. I once went to a convention in Seattle, and three people gave me gifts of an umbrella for the trip. It didn't rain. I hope this book has a few surprises for you. Saul Stein, Scarborough, New York, May 1995. Part 1, The Essentials. Chapter 1, The Writer's Job May Be Different Than You Think. This is not a book of theory. It is a book of usable solutions. How to fix writing that is flawed, how to improve writing that is good, how to create interesting writing in the first place. For 36 years, I worked one-on-one with writers who had contract deadlines. My primary interest was to provide them with the techniques for solving editorial problems and improving their work in time to meet their deadlines. I could not provide writers with new genes, an ear, or talent. What I passed on was the craft other writers had developed to get their manuscripts in shape for publication. As an editor and publisher, I frequently heard that an editor's job was to help the writer realize his intentions. That is true, except for the fact that many writers have inappropriate intentions. The four most common I've heard are, "I am expressing myself," "I have something to say," "I want to be loved by readers," and "I need money." Those are all occasional outcomes of the correct intention, which is to provide the reader with an experience that is superior to the experiences the reader encounters in everyday life. If the reader is also rewarded with insights, it is not always the result of the writer's wisdom, but of the writer's ability to create the conditions that enable pleasure to edify. The writer comes to the editor bearing his talent, experience, and hope for his manuscript. The editor provides distance, experience with other writers, and the tools of craft that are efficient substitutes for trial and error. I have had the good fortune to work with some of the most successful writers of our time. They had much to teach me. What they taught and what they may have learned is in this book. As a young writer brimming with hope and arrogance, I was subjected, luckily, to the wisdom and tyranny of several extraordinary teachers of writing. Wilmer Stone, Theodore Goodman, Jacques Barsoun, Lionel Trilling, and Thornton Wilder. I would like to convey the most important thing I learned from each. Wilmer Stone was faculty advisor to The Magpie, the literary magazine of DeWitt Clinton High School in the Bronx, New York, then one of the best-known public secondary schools in the United States. In those remarkable days, DeWitt Clinton served not only its neighborhood, but qualified students from anywhere else in the vastness of New York City. One of them was James Baldwin, who each school day took the long subway ride from Harlem and Manhattan to DeWitt Clinton at the topmost part of the Bronx. Out of our adolescent camaraderie came his most extraordinary book, Notes of a Native Son, which he much later would claim I compelled him to publish. Each Friday afternoon at 3, while other students decamped for their homes, the lights were on in the Magpie Tower, high above the rectangle of the school. There, Wilmer Stone met with Richard Avedon, then a poet, who became one of the most famous photographers in the world, the editor Emile Capuya, Jimmy Baldwin, myself, and a few others whose names hide behind the scrim of time. What went on in that tower was excruciatingly painful. Wilmer Stone read our stories to us in a monotone, as if he were reading from the pages of a phone directory. What we learned with each stab of pain was that the words themselves and not the inflections supplied by the reader had to carry the emotion of the story. Today, I still hear the metronome of Wilmer Stone's voice and counsel my students to have their drafts read to them by a friend who has the least talent for acting and is capable of reading words as if they had no meaning. My family was depression poor, and the only college I could try for was one whose expense could be as close to zero as possible. In those days, the College of the City of New York, better known as CCNY, took in the top 15% of New York City high school graduates, whose only expense would be secondhand books and subway fare. There, Theodore Goodman's reputation was such that all who had a craving to write gravitated toward his classes. To teach short story writing, he had us read James Joyce's The Dead over and over. It was from this practice that I learned the value of dissecting a piece of writing repeatedly until it surrendered its secrets. The most important thing I took away from Teddy Goodman came about at the beginning of the one private conference each student was entitled to. I was by then a head taller than Goodman, but he was Napoleon to us all. He glared at me and said, "Look how you're dressed." I looked down and could see only what I had seen in the mirror that morning, the suit and shirt and tie that was customary for students at the time. "Your suit is blue," he said. "Your shirt is blue, your tie is blue. That's what's wrong with your writing." When my ordeal was over, I slunk away from Goodman's cubicle to rethink the sameness of my writing and to learn the value of variety. It took some time for me to learn the other lesson, that a writer, shy or not, needs a tough skin. For no matter how advanced one's experience and career, expert criticism cuts to the quick, and one learns to endure and to perfect, if for no other reason than to challenge the pain maker. The master's seminar I attended at Columbia University was with William York Tyndall, who continued Goodman's process of closely examining a single piece of work to teach us how to read other works. That seminar created an appetite for what was then quite possibly the best-known doctoral seminar in America, led in discordant concert by two extraordinary men, Jacques Barsoun and Lionel Trilling, both of whom left their marks in writing as well as teaching. The official title of the seminar was Backgrounds in Contemporary Thought and Culture. Its true subject was, "So you think you know how to write? Let's see." It was a tough course to get into. 35 were selected, and only 8 students survived the academic year. Each week we had to read a designated book and write a piece about it. The piece would come under as close a scrutiny as any editor ever gave a work. A cocky Saul Stein thought he would trick his advisors and submitted a typed version of an article of his that had already been published as the lead piece in an academic journal. Barzun and Trilling skewered my prose with almost as much comment in the margins as I had on the page. What had been acceptable to the magazine was not acceptable to their higher standard. What I learned from my destroyed work were the 2 simple objectives of all prose writing, to be clear and to be precise. Precision and clarity became my watchwords, my guides to self-correction, and my most prized editing tools, especially 6 or 7 years later when I was editing the work of both Barzun and Trilling for the Mid-Century Magazine. I was a playwright long before I became a novelist. In 1952, a year before I saw my first play on stage, I was granted back-to-back playwriting fellowships at Yaddo, the Artists' Colony in Saratoga Springs, New York, and the McDowell Colony in Peterborough, New Hampshire. To my astonishment, my employer, the U.S. State Department, granted me leave for both. At Yaddo, I occupied what was known as the Carson McCullers Cottage, though the vibrations came not from the spirit of Carson McCullers, but from 2,000 bees whose colony was embedded in the hollow wall. On arriving at McDowell, I was given an even greater surprise for a young playwright. Though most of the people there were composers and painters, there was one other playwright, Thornton Wilder. What a mind-walloping opportunity! One of the most accomplished American playwrights of the century and a neophyte working on his first play in the same environment. Thornton Wilder taught me 2 things. First, the necessity of sitting through bad plays, to witness coughing and squirming in the audience, to have ears up like a rabbit to catch what didn't work, to observe how little tolerance an audience has for a mishap, 10 seconds of boredom breaking an hour-long spell. I was soon to take advantage of the New Dramatists Committee, an organization that enabled me to see free of charge some 60 plays in less than 2 years. I learned more from the painfully bad than from the few remarkable plays that kept me enthralled. Today, I urge my students, once they have begun to master craft, to read a few chapters of John Grisham's The Firm, or some other transient bestseller, to see what they can learn from the mistakes of writers who don't heed the precise meanings of the words they use. They also learn to read the work of literary prize winners to detect the rare uncaught error in craft. What they are doing is perfecting their editorial eye and their self-editing talent, learning to read as a writer. Wilder taught me something else. He took me to watch a country square dance from an unoccupied balcony in a recreation hall and pointed out things that writers are supposed to see. The New Hampshire folk came to dances in families, mothers, fathers, and adolescent children. As we watched from the balcony, Wilder pointed out the barely noticeable sexual interplay between fathers and daughters and mothers and sons as they danced the evening away. In the 50s, a dull age in which so much was forbidden, Wilder taught me that what a writer deals with is the unspoken, what people see or sense in silence. It is our job, in nonfiction as well as fiction, to juxtapose words that reveal what previously may have been blinked, and provide insights obscured by convention and shame. The century I have inhabited has not seen the abandonment of war and violence. It has not solved the problem of poverty, nor has it improved human nature. However, we can credit the century with producing the public realization that sex has to be good for both partners. That is also the key to writing both fiction and nonfiction. It has to be a good experience for both partners, the writer and the reader, and it is a source of distress to me to observe how frequently writers ignore the pleasure of their partners. The pleasure of writer and reader are interwoven. The seasoned writer of both nonfiction and fiction, confident in his craft, derives increasing pleasure from his work. The reader, in the hands of a writer who has mastered his craft, enjoys a richer experience. When I ask a group of professional writers to state the essential difference between nonfiction and fiction, most are unable to do so. and when they try, an audience of 100 will provide answers so disparate as to seem to come from 100 different planets rather than common experience. Let us state the difference in the simplest way. Nonfiction conveys information. Fiction evokes emotion. Because the intended results are so different, the mindsets required for writing fiction and nonfiction are different. In fiction, when information obtrudes, the experience of the story pauses. Raw information comes across as an interruption, the author filling in. The fiction writer must avoid anything that distracts from the experience, even momentarily. A failure to understand this difference between nonfiction and fiction is a major reason for the rejection of novels. Though the ostensible purpose of nonfiction is the conveyance of information, if that information is in a raw state, the writing seems pedestrian, black and white facts in a colorful world. The reader, soon bored, yearns for the images, anecdotes, characterization, and writerly precision that make informational writing come alive on the page. That is where the techniques of fiction can be so helpful to the nonfiction writer. Over many years, I have observed that the failure of story writers is often attributable to an incontrovertible fact. We are all writers from an early age. Most of what we write is nonfiction: essays for school, letters to friends, memoranda to colleagues, in which we are trying to pass on information. We are raised with a traditional nonfiction mindset. Even when we write love letters, we are trying to communicate how we feel, and not necessarily trying to evoke an emotion in the recipient, though that might be better suited to our purpose. In previous centuries, when letter writing was more often than today a form of personal art, letters had more of an emotional effect on readers, even those to whom the writing was not addressed, as we know from reading some of the great correspondence that has been collected in books. The lifelong habit of writing traditional nonfiction, passing on information, is curable through attention to the fiction writer's primary job, which is creating an emotional experience for the reader. The novelist is like the conductor of an orchestra, his back to the audience, his face invisible, summoning the experience of music for the people he cannot see. The writer, as conductor, also gets to compose the music and play all of the instruments, a task less formidable than it seems. What it requires is the conscious practice of providing an extraordinary experience for the reader, who should be oblivious to the fact that he is seeing words on paper. A second matter insinuates itself between the writer and success. All of us, in our daily speech to others, are not only trying to communicate information, but to get something off our minds and into the consciousness of the listeners. When we write, we put down on paper what we think, know, or believe we know, and pay little attention to the effect on the reader. That is discourteous in life and unsuccessful in writing. We practice our craft to service the reader, not our psyches. The material we deal with may come from our observation and insight. As writers, we don't expel the result as raw material. We transmute it to provide what the reader most wants, an experience different from and richer than what he daily abides in life. As E.L. Doctorow once put it, good writing is supposed to evoke sensation in the reader, not the fact that it's raining, but the feeling of being rained upon. The good news is that nonfiction mindset has been changing. In recent years, ambitious journalists and writers of nonfiction books have increasingly adopted some of the techniques of fiction to enhance the reader's experience of their writing. In journalism, the change has been revolutionary. In the early part of the 20th century, journalists were taught to provide readers with the who, what, when, where, and why of their stories in the first paragraph. The result was the reader read the first paragraph and, sated, moved on to the first paragraph of the next story. How frustrating it must have been for journalists writing pieces of 10 or 15 or 20 paragraphs, finding readers skipping away after the first. Today, the best of good journalists are arousing their readers' curiosity in the first paragraph and seducing them into the rest of the story. A news story has become a story that contains the news. In television, where new programs are frequent and often short-lived, One exemplar of broadcast journalism that has lasted more than a quarter of a century is 60 Minutes, which weekly holds an audience of tens of millions. Its creator, Don Hewitt, tells us, "TV is good not when you see it or hear it, but when you feel it." Though it deals in fact, 60 Minutes, like fiction, is concerned with evoking the emotions of its audience. Don Hewitt's creation thrives on the revelation of character. Its interviewers peel layers of camouflage to reveal matters that its subjects would rather conceal. It uncovers cover-ups. It causes people to speak of things that are revelatory, incriminating, or painful. The segments often bring out the dark side of human nature, which at times excites its audience interest in the opposite, justice and goodwill. It does, in other words, what creative writing aspires to. It should not be surprising that 60 Minutes has had imitators that do not imitate well, programs of scandal and gossip laden with sentimentality and cloaked in melodrama. An unfortunate amount of so-called transient fiction does the same thing. Though the new nonfiction uses some of the techniques of fiction, important differences exist. Nonfiction stems from fact, and all attempts to evoke emotion in its readership cannot, or at least should not, take leave from its roots. It can make us feel what happened, but dares not invent what happened. Nonfiction can describe effectively what people do and thereby move us, but it cannot invent those actions. Nonfiction can report what people say, but it cannot guess what they were thinking. To help us understand the essential difference between nonfiction and fiction, let's look at an example. Traditional nonfiction. New York City has more than 1,400 homeless people. Better nonfiction. The man who has laid claim to the bench on the corner of 88th Street and Park Avenue is one of New York City's 1,400 homeless people. Fiction. His skin the color of rust, the man sits on his park bench next to his bag of belongings, staring at the brightly lit windows in the apartments across the street, at the strange race of people who still have hope. In the transition from plain fact to fiction, we lose statistics and focus on the individual character. The writer, having invented the character, can convey what the character thinks. To orient us, consider for a moment the relationship between the writer, the book, and the reader. The writer, of course, writes the book. The book then acts on the reader's mind and emotions unseen by the writer. In fact, when the writer finishes his work, he can vanish from the earth, and his book will continue to affect the reader's mind and emotions. The writer becomes dispensable. The work must do the job. Can a novelist or story writer work on the reader's emotions consciously while writing a first draft? Not easily, except through long practice and prowess. But the less experienced writer can plan the reader's adventure before he writes each scene, and in revising that scene after a respite away from it, with the steel gaze of an editor, he can see how the reader's experience might be improved. What of the nonfiction writer who sees himself solely as the communicator of fact, who is offended by the idea of working on the emotions of his audience? We sometimes speak of academic writing, of courtroom transcripts, of material that does not compel our attention or elicit a strong desire to continue reading, as dry. What we mean by dry is that it does not enable us to see as we read. It does not move us, and most important, it does not stimulate our intellect with insight, its ostensible purpose. The writers of thousands of academic articles and books each year, of hundreds of thousands of legal papers and millions of business memoranda, are discourteous to their readers and fail in their purpose. They do not understand the power of language or the techniques for its use. Isn't there something distasteful in evoking the emotions of an audience? Some of the great villains of our age have been spellbinders working the public's emotions. In old newsreels, we see Hitler in the Nuremberg Stadium or Mussolini on his balcony building frenzy in an audience that has abdicated sense for sensation. But we are moved by heroes as well, often as a result of war. Lincoln, Churchill, Roosevelt. Their effect lies in the language they are cloaked in. Let us consider for a moment the most admired of the three. The historian Shelby Foote reminds us, Lincoln was highly intelligent. Almost everything he did was calculated for effect. That statement is one no writer should ever forget. Almost everything he did was calculated for effect. We like to think of ourselves as moved to action by facts and reason. Yet we shrink from politicians who may have got their facts right, but who bore us with language that is flat, cliché-ridden, robbed of effectiveness by their unimaginative prose. They want us to agree. What we feel is utter boredom. Researchers, scientists, academicians marshal their facts to a higher standard, but with their neglect of the emotive power of language, they often speak only to each other, their parochial words dropping like sand on a private desert. Despite our alleged reverence for fact, the truth is that our adrenaline rises most in response to effective expression. When a writer or speaker understands the electricity of fresh simile and metaphor, his choice of words empowers our feelings, his language compels our attention, acceptance, and action. When Shakespeare speaks, when Lincoln orates, we are moved not by information, but by the excellence of their diction. Alone in a living room, our book lit by a chairside lamp, we are enraptured by what is said because of the author's choice of words and their order on the page. The best of good writing will entice us into subjects and knowledge we would have declared were of no interest to us until we were seduced by the language they were dressed in. This book encompasses both modes of writing, fiction and nonfiction. The practitioners of each have different attitudes. In my experience, most novelists and short story writers are eager to improve their craft, even after they have published many times. Nonfiction writers, who do not have to create living characters, are sometimes complacent about a craft in which publication comes easier and is paid for with greater regularity. This book may inspire some nonfiction writers to reach for treasure on a higher shelf. Fiction and nonfiction both can benefit from the writer's imagination as well as his memory. For the story writer, witnessing or remembering incidents in life must be more than an act of reporting. It is the taking off point not of what happened, but of what might have happened. That is what enables some fiction to provide us with an experience that we characterize as extraordinary. Reporting in nonfiction can be accurate, like a photograph taken merely to record. The best of nonfiction, however, sets what it sees in a framework, what has happened elsewhere or in the past. As the recorded events march before us, a scrim lifts to convey another dimension. The highlighting focuses our attention. Sight becomes insight. Reporting becomes art. The evidence is in this book. For the writer who intends to master his craft, I have a small craft warning. Imagine yourself as a youngster standing beside a bicycle for the first time. You watched someone riding this two-wheeled vehicle in a straight line. You may have wondered how the rider kept his balance, why the bicycle didn't tip over. At your side is an experienced bicyclist who tells you how it's done. You learn that by holding the handlebars steady and pedaling fast, the bicycle moves forward without tipping. You are told that by steering gently with the handlebars, turning the front wheel in the direction you want to go, you can manipulate the vehicle elegantly, avoiding pedestrians and other obstacles as long as you keep pedaling. If you stop pedaling or even slow too much, the bicycle will become unstable, wobbly, and your control of it will loosen until the bicycle will sway to one side and start to fall. You learn that to halt, you have to press the handbrakes just so and be prepared to lower a leg for stability as you come to a stop. Those are the essentials of cycling, but it doesn't mean you can ride a bicycle. What you need is practice. You learn to coordinate your movements. You discover how rapidly you have to rotate the pedals in order to keep the bicycle moving, and how to redirect the handlebars gradually to turn a corner. Only with repetition do you find out how to slow down and stop without tipping over. Once you master riding, what you have learned will stay with you for the rest of your life. You may abandon the bicycle for an automobile, then years later take it up for exercise and find that in moments you are rolling ahead, fully coordinated, your brain responding to what you learned in your practice sessions long ago. It is the same with writing. Except that writers provide themselves with a monumental obstacle to achieving skill. Ballet dancers practice technique. Pianists wear down their black and white keys with hours of daily practice. Actors rehearse and rehearse again. Painters perfect still life objects at various angles, practice obtaining the best perspectives, experiment with color and texture, do sketches in preparation for oil. By practice, one learns to use what one has understood. Only writers, it seems, expect to achieve some level of mastery without practice. Do all writers resist the techniques that will help them master their craft? No. Some, eager to get published, seize on the advice of anybody with an authoritative title or a persuasive personality. Others find excuses for not writing at the same time every day, balk at re-revising incessantly, or excuse themselves because their lives are beset by difficulties. I am deaf to that excuse because I worked with the most disadvantaged writer in history, Christy Brown, who had the use of his brain, the little toe on his left foot, and little else. When he was a seemingly helpless baby lying on the kitchen floor of a cottage in Ireland, his remarkable mother saw him reach out with his left foot and, with his one good toe, manage to pick up a crayon that one of his siblings had dropped. That was the beginning of a writer. Eventually, someone at IBM made a special typewriter for Christy that enabled him to punch in a letter at a time with his one working toe. I published 5 of Christy Brown's books, one of which made the national bestseller lists. I urge you to see the video of a remarkable film called My Left Foot. It won an Oscar for Daniel Day-Lewis, who played Christy. The film may cure you of fishing for an excuse for not writing. Once in California, I had a letter from a nonfiction writer who wanted desperately to write fiction, but wondered if at 60 she was too old to begin. I told her that Ilya Kazan was 57 when he started with fiction, and that I had published 4 active octogenarians in a single year, the lexicographer Eric Partridge, J.B. Priestley, Hannah Tillich, and Bertram Wolfe. If you're a writer, you are never retired by someone else. You not only keep going, but the very act of writing helps keep you alive. More than half a millennium ago, Chaucer, the great English writer of the Middle Ages, had this to say about the writer's work. "The life so short, the craft so long to learn, the say so hard, so sharp the conquering." Life is short, Chaucer is telling us. The craft takes long to learn. The work is hard, but, when it is right, the writer's triumph soars. Few among contemporary writers have expressed that pleasure as well as Kate Braverman did about finishing her remarkable short story, Tall Tales from the Mekong Delta. Writing is like hunting. There are brutally cold afternoons with nothing in sight, only the wind and your breaking heart. Then the moment when you bag something big. The entire process is beyond intoxicating. As soon as Lenny began speaking, I knew I had mainlined it. I felt like I was strapped in the cockpit with the stars in my face and the expanding universe on my back. In my opinion, that's the only way a writer should travel. When I finished Tall Tales, I thought, this one is a keeper. This is a trophy brought back from the further realm, the kingdom of perpetual glistening night where we know ourselves absolutely. This one goes on the wall. As you perfect your craft through practice, remember the joy of finally getting on a bicycle and riding to your destination without giving a second thought to the technique that now comes naturally. Experience the pleasure of getting the right word, the right phrase, the right sentence, the right paragraph, and finally the ecstasy of creating a keeper for your wall. Chapter 2. Come right in. First sentences, first paragraphs. Fiction. Ilya Kazan, brilliant director of stage and screen, as well as a late-blooming novelist, told me that audiences give a film 7 minutes. If the viewer is not intrigued by a character or incident within that time, the film and its viewer are at odds. The viewer came for an experience. The film is disappointing him. Today's impatient readers give a novelist fewer than 7 minutes. Some years ago, I was involved in an informal study of the behavior of lunch hour browsers in mid-Manhattan bookstores. In the fiction section, the most common pattern was for the browser to read the front flap of the book's jacket, then go to page 1. No browser went beyond page 3 before either taking the book to the cashier or putting the book down and picking up another to sample. Thereafter, whenever an author told me that his novel really got going on page 10 or 20 or 30, I had to pass on the news that his book in all likelihood was doomed, unless he could revise it so that the first 3 pages aroused the reader's interest, enough to quarantine him from distraction for the several hours the book demanded from him. Readers have not grown more patient since that bit of research was conducted. Today, first sentences and first paragraphs of any writing are increasingly important for arousing the restless reader. Arousal is nature's stimulus for the propagation of the human race. The unaroused male of the species is as useless for that purpose as a worm. Arousal can happen sooner or later, but it must happen. Similarly, arousal is an author's stimulus for the reader. Without early arousal, the reader does not yet trust that he will enjoy the experience that the writer has prepared. The ideal goals of an opening paragraph are 1. To excite the reader's curiosity, preferably about a character or a relationship. 2. To introduce a setting. 3. To lend resonance to the story. Long before I edited a couple of Bud Schulberg's books, he published his first novel, What Makes Sammy Run, a book whose opening I like to quote from. Sammy was a huge bestseller in 1941. This is the way it starts. The first time I saw him, he couldn't have been more than 16 years old, a little ferret of a kid, sharp and quick. Sammy Glick. Used to run copy for me, always ran, always looked thirsty. To prove that writers know what works even if they don't take advantage of their knowledge in their own writing, I ask my students to pick out the most important word in Schulberg's opening. See if you can't find it in the paragraph just quoted. Most writers quickly come up with the correct answer, ferret. It characterizes 16-year-old Sammy in a flash. Next, I ask for the second most important word in that paragraph. See if you can detect it. That may take a bit more time, but after a moment's thought, a majority will zero in on thirsty, an original way of saying Sammy was hungry, meaning ambitious. The words always ran convey quickly that Sammy is a hustler. That opening is an inspiring example of quick characterization, and especially of a way to arouse the reader's interest because, in a few words, we sense a conflict brewing. The narrator knows Sammy is overly ambitious. The kid wants what? Everything. Therein lies a clue. As readers, we are immediately interested in a character who wants something badly. The fact that the narrator is Sammy's boss also piques the reader's curiosity. Will the narrator continue to put up with Sammy's drive? Will Sammy get fired? Will Sammy succeed? And if so, at what and how will he do it? The story is off and running in the first paragraph. We want to know what will happen. At the time that Schulberg wrote What Makes Sammy Run, he wasn't an old master. He was a young first novelist. If one understands the principles of intriguing the reader, one doesn't need decades of experience. James T. Farrell, a friend who achieved fame for his novel Studs Lonergan, once gave me a copy of a collection of his short stories called French Girls Are Vicious, in which the title story contains an interesting example for writers. The narrator begins, "I don't like French girls. Perhaps it's because of my Puritan upbringing." We assume the speaker is a man. At the beginning of the second paragraph, a surprise is waiting for us. The narrator is a woman. Our curiosity is aroused when a surprise unsettles our expectation. It is astonishing how much the first words of a novel or story affect editors, reviewers, and readers. They are the trigger of curiosity, what writers have long called the narrative hook. In addition, the early words suggest the kind of book one is reading. Thornton Wilder, my early mentor in playwriting, also wrote novels, the most famous of which, The bridge of San Luis Rey starts this way. On Friday noon, July the 20th, 1714, the finest bridge in all Peru broke and precipitated 5 travelers into the gulf below. It's precise as to date and time and the number of people, but the key to arousing our interest is in the words, finest bridge. Bridges deteriorate, many are hazardous, but this bridge that suddenly hurtled 5 people to their death was the finest. We want to know what happened and why. Here's another. Yank Lucas fell asleep late one night and left the gas burning on the kitchen range. We want to know more. That's the opening of John O'Hara's 1967 novel, The Instrument. James Baldwin began his short story, Going to Meet the Man, with this unembellished way of interesting the reader. What's the matter? She asked. Here's a quieter yet intriguing opening sentence by one of the century's grand masters, Graham Greene, from an early 1935 novel, England Made Me. She might have been waiting for her lover. Maxine Hong Kingston kindled the reader's interest in The Woman Warrior with the kind of hook that almost always works. You must not tell anyone, my mother said, what I am about to tell you. See how much Irwin Shaw accomplished in the first sentence of his story, The 80-Yard Run. The pass was high and wide, and he jumped for it, feeling it slap flatly against his hands as he shook his hips to throw off the halfback who was diving at him. Anthony Burgess, in both his fiction and nonfiction, enjoyed shocking the reader into attention. The following attention-getter is the opening of his 22nd novel, Earthly Powers. It was the afternoon of my 81st birthday, and I was in bed with my catamite when Ali announced the Archbishop had come to see me. That first sentence tells us the narrator is old, that he is in bed with someone of the same sex, that this is a regular event in his life, and the event this day is being interrupted by a visit from an archbishop. That certainly piques the reader's curiosity about what kind of confrontation is about to happen. Another example. On the day he lost his right foot, Walter Van Brunt had been haunted, however haphazardly, by ghosts of the past. Losing a foot is not an everyday occurrence. From the first sentence, we know we are going to witness an important day in the life of Walter Van Brunt. Moreover, Van Brunt is haunted by ghosts of the past. Who or what are they? The interjection, however haphazardly, conveys a touch of literary flavor. Would a commercial action-adventure author ever say, however haphazardly? That's a lot to get from a first sentence. It's from a 1987 novel, World's End, by T. Corrigison Boyle, who has been called one of the most gifted writers of his generation. Saul Bellow, winner of the Nobel Prize for Literature, most often uses characterization to attract a reader's attention. Here are the opening sentences of 4 of his novels. When it came to concealing his troubles, Tommy Wilhelm was not less capable than the next fellow. What made me take this trip to Africa? If I am out of my mind, it's all right with me, thought Moses Herzog. Shortly after dawn, or what would have been dawn in a normal sky, Mr. Arthur Samler, with his bushy eye, took in the books and papers of his west side bedroom, and suspected strongly that they were the wrong books, the wrong papers. In order, the openings are from Bellow's first novel, Seize the Day, Henderson the Rain King, his most celebrated novel, Herzog, and Mr. Samler's Planet. Note that all of Bellow's beginnings, except Henderson, seize the attention of the reader by characterization, which we get soon enough. All right, you say. These are well-known writers, prize-winning writers. What about writers like me? Fair enough. Here are some first sentences from work by students of mine who have yet to publish. I wanted to strangle Mother, but I'd have to touch her to do it. That's by Loretta Hudson. The narrator wants to perform an act that is taboo and punishable, but what causes the reaction of the reader is the countervailing force, the repugnance at having to touch the person you want to strangle. I have heard audiences gasp when that opening sentence is read to them. The same student started a story with an entirely different hook in the first sentence. It would have been nice if the stork had dropped me down the right chimney. That visual opening presents the narrator's problem, the wrong parents, in an attention-grabbing way. How abstract the beginning would have sounded had the author started, "I was born to the wrong parents." Here's one by another beginner. A telephone ringing in the middle of the night is not a welcome sound. What should be clear by now is that writers with differing skills and experiences have all tried to engage the reader's curiosity at the outset. There are questions you can ask yourself about your own first sentence. Does it convey an interesting personality or an action that we want to know more about? Can you make your first sentence more intriguing by introducing something unusual, something shocking perhaps, or something that will surprise the reader? Your entire story or novel may depend on that first sentence arresting the reader's attention. A terrific sentence on page 2 won't help if the reader never gets there. Is it absolutely essential for the first sentence to hook the reader? The first sentence of the next example is a simple statement of the narrator's name. The rest of the paragraph appears, on the surface, to be conventional, but is it? It's from the title story of John Cheever's short story collection, The Housebreaker of Shady Hill. Footnote: The Housebreaker on Shady Hill has always held a special interest for me because I've lived in that house for more than 30 years. I hasten to add, we are not the people in that house. The house on Shady Hill is not the house Johnny Hake lives in. It is the house he steals from in the story. My name is Johnny Hake. I'm 30 years old, stand 5'11" in my socks, weigh 142 pounds stripped, and am, so to speak, naked at the moment and talking into the dark. I was conceived in the Hotel St. Regis, born in the Presbyterian Hospital, raised on Sutton Place, christened and confirmed in St. Bartholomew's, and I drilled with the Knickerbocker Grays, played football and baseball in Central Park, learned to chin myself on the framework of East Side apartment house canopies, and met my wife, Christina Lewis, at one of those big cotillions at the Waldorf. I served 4 years in the Navy, have 4 kids now, and live in a banlieue called Shady Hill. We have a nice house with a garden and a place outside for cooking meat, and on summer nights, sitting there with the kids and looking into the front of Christina's dress as she bends over to salt the steaks, or just gazing at the lights in heaven, I'm thrilled by more hardy and dangerous pursuits, and I guess this is what is meant by the pain and sweetness of life. You can't be more direct than that. There's Johnny Hake encapsulating his life for the reader. Cheever, however, is a sly craftsman. In the first sentence, his character lets drop that he is naked at the moment and talking into the dark. Not the kind of thing you'd put into a resume. A few more sentences, and he's looking into the front of Christina's dress as she bends over to salt the steaks. That's in the middle of a sentence, seemingly a throwaway, but in fact a hook for the reader. A craftsman like Cheever will season even the most conventional beginning with just enough that is unconventional to rouse the reader's curiosity. John Fowles is one of the most accomplished novels of this century. His career began in 1963 with the publication of a relatively simple novel called The Collector. If you haven't read it, I urge you to. Let's look at how he starts the book. When she was home from her boarding school, I used to see her almost every day sometimes, because their house was right opposite the town hall annex. She and her younger sister used to go in and out a lot, often with young men, which, of course, I didn't like. The end of the second sentence is the first omen of what proves to be an exceptionally suspenseful book. Let's see how the first paragraph continues. When I had a free moment from the files and ledgers, I stood by the window and used to look down over the road, over the frosting, and sometimes I'd see her. In the evening, I marked it in my observations diary, at first with X, and then when I knew her name, with M. I saw her several times outside, too. I stood right behind her once in a queue at the public library down Crossfield Street. She didn't look once at me, but I watched the back of her head and her hair in a long pigtail. It was very pale, silky, like Burnett cocoons. All in one pigtail coming down almost to her waist, sometimes in front, sometimes at the back. Sometimes she wore it up. Only once, before she came to be my guest here, did I have the privilege to see her with it loose, and it took my breath away, it was so beautiful, like a mermaid. That first long paragraph introduces the two main characters, the narrator and his victim. Note the amount of concrete detail. I will reproduce that paragraph, highlighting the ominous phrases. When she was home from her boarding school, I used to see her almost every day sometimes, because their house was right opposite the town hall annex. She and her younger sister used to go in and out a lot, often with young men. Which, of course, I didn't like. When I had a free moment from the files and ledgers, I stood by the window and used to look down over the road, over the frosting, and sometimes I'd see her. In the evening, I marked it in my observations diary, at first with X, and then, when I knew her name, with M. I saw her several times outside, too. I stood right behind once in a queue at the public library down Crossfield Street. She didn't look once at me, but I watched the back of her head and her hair in a long pigtail. It was very pale, silky, like Burnett cocoons. All in one pigtail coming down almost to her waist, sometimes in front, sometimes at the back. Sometimes she wore it up. Only once. Before she came to be my guest here. Did I have the privilege to see her with it loose, and it took my breath away. It was so beautiful, like a mermaid. As a reader, what do we take away from that first paragraph? The narrator didn't like M seeing other young men, though she didn't even know him. He kept an observations diary. He found out her name. Once he stood right behind her. She didn't notice him, but he was studying her hair as if he were preparing to become her lover. And she came to be my guest? What she becomes is his prisoner. An even more sly craftsman is Vladimir Nabokov. Here's the beginning of his most famous novel. Lolita, light of my life, fire of my loins, my sin, my soul, Lolita. The tip of the tongue taking the trip of three steps down the palate to tap at three on the teeth, Lolita. The second paragraph continues. She was low, plain low in the morning, standing 4'10" in one sock. She was Lola in slacks. She was Dolly at school. She was Dolores on the dotted line. But in my arms, she was always Lolita. That's ostensibly the first paragraph of Vladimir Nabokov's Lolita, which created a sensation when it was published in 1955. Ostensibly, because we find there's a foreword in front of the novel signed by one John Ray, Jr., Ph.D. Nabokov liked to have fun with his audience, and so in front of the book proper, he planted a mock foreword supposedly written by a scholar. That foreword is as intriguing as the beginning of the actual book. It describes the book as a confession, tells us the book's author died in prison, uses concrete specifics, a diagnosis, a date, a lawyer's name, and let's drop that the writer of the foreword was himself awarded a prize for a modest work in which certain morbid states and perversions were discussed. We might say that Nabokov began Lolita twice, and both beginnings, in different ways, were designed to excite the interest of the reader. The opening paragraphs of Lolita proper, the announcing of the sounds of her name and the revelation that the protagonist is having an affair with a schoolgirl, pulls the reader in two ways. Scandalous subject matter and the immediate sense that here is a writer who plays with language artfully. I thought it might be useful to follow a writer's thoughts as he developed a first paragraph. I am not psychic. The experience I tapped is my own. The lawyer George Thomasy appeared in my novels The Magician, The Childkeeper, and Other People. When it came time for him to appear again in The Touch of Treason, I wanted to start with Thomasy looking over a courtroom where he was to try a major case. My objectives for that beginning were the three that I suggested earlier: to lend resonance to the story, to convey Thomasy's personality to new readers and reintroduce him to those who had encountered him before, to establish a courtroom setting. In the end, you died. There could be a courtroom like this, Thomasy thought. All the good wood bleached white, the judge deaf to objections because he owned the place, the law was his, the advocacy system finished. If that's what it was going to be like, George Thomasy wanted to live forever, because here on earth, God willing or not, you could fight back. The courtroom Thomasy is viewing is in his mind. He is imagining the courtroom of Judgment Day. The reader knows the judge is he, and he owned the place, the law was his. It is apparent that Thomasy resents the authority of judges. Thomasy wants an arena where he can fight back. His most characteristic trait is to try to win under every circumstance, yet to continue to do so would be impossible. He would have to live forever. That's a lot to cram into a few lines. I hoped the essence of my intent would come across, and that the reader, at minimum, would be anticipating the courtroom drama to come. What can a newcomer do in a first paragraph? A lot. The following is the first paragraph of a novel by a student in my advanced fiction seminar who was writing about a painter. Shoshana stormed through the silent apartment. "Mason, you son of a bitch, where are you?" Instinct told her. Mason had fled. "You gutless coward," she raged. Returning to her studio, Shoshana stabbed the brush she carried into a jar of turpentine. Just try to get in 1 hour's ego-affirming work of one's own. No way. The writer, Anne Mudgett, is using action to characterize. She is also setting up conflict between the narrator and Mason, and involving the reader in Shoshana's emotional state. We saw how James T. Farrell used surprise. In the example that follows, surprise is used by a student, Steve Talsky, whose work is yet to be published. "I am the way, the answer, and the light. Through me all things are possible." He had written this once as a joke on the headboard of his bed. The reader gets an impression of a character who is unusual and about whom one wants to know more. Not least, one has the sense that this author's work has resonance. The value of a well-written opening is that it makes the reader ready to give himself to the writer's imagined people for the duration. It should be clear by now that the unusual is a factor in arousing the reader's interest, and so is action and conflict. So many writers fight an uphill battle trying to interest their readers in matters that have no inherent conflict. The worst possible way to start a story is with something like, "They were a wonderful couple. He loved her and she loved him. They never argued." The result is instant boredom. Boredom is the greatest enemy of both reader and writer. Do we gaze with wonder at the nice, average, normal-looking people we pass in the street? Our attention is arrested by the seven-footer and the midget, the oldster with the mechanical waddle, the child who bounces as she walks. Recall how people react to the sound of metal crunching metal, announcing an accident. They hasten to see what happened. Highways get choked when drivers slow down to gawk at the remains of a collision. To the student of literature, it should come as no surprise that news programs concentrate on bad news first, on events filled with conflict. Beginning a book with an intriguing opening is the easy way to capture the reader. There are, however, more leisurely ways to seduce the reader through omens. You have heard people say, "I've got a feeling something is going to happen." How is that done? In The Magician, the opening pages convey the town of Ossining at the end of a month of intermittent snowfall. Boys in twos and threes with shovels are clearing neighbors' sidewalks. The third sentence has a slight omen. An occasional older man, impoverished or proud, could be seen daring death with a shovel in hand, clearing steps so that one could get in and out of the house, or using a small snowblower on a driveway in the hope of getting his wife to the supermarket and back before the next snow fell. Daring death is an omen, and the rhythm of the words at the end of the sentence is designed to strengthen the ominous feeling in "the next snow fell." The second paragraph also ends with the thump, thump, thump of monosyllabic words. It seemed impossible that spring might come, and that these humped gray masses would eventually vanish as water into the heel-hard ground. I then lift the reader's spirit with a sight of huge evergreens dusted with snow, and above them the bare webs of leafless silver maples reflecting sunlight. We see young children enjoying the snow. During a brief tour, we find out we are the richest country in the United States, but the center of the village of Ossining has numerous empty storefronts. Nearby homes have been fled from, and another omen central to the book looms. The biggest drain on taxes was, of course, the schools, in which violence was not unknown. And soon another. It was not an unusual town in a country on the decline after only two centuries. In the next paragraph, still on page 2, we find out that the most famous site in that village is Sing Sing Prison, known throughout the world. And we innocently, it seems, then find ourselves watching the protagonist, a young man named Ed Jaffet, practicing magic tricks in front of a large mirror in his parents' bedroom. Of course, I could have started with that scene, but I preferred the gentle build-up of omens that something is wrong in the village where the action takes place, in the country, perhaps in the world. The reader's apprehension has been raised. Something is going to happen, and it does. Sometimes a single omen can do the work of several if it starts the engine of the novel. A novel is like a car. It won't go anywhere until you turn on the engine. The engine of both fiction and nonfiction is the point at which the reader makes the decision not to put the book down. The engine should start in the first three pages. The closer to the top of page 1, the better. Josiah Bunting, novelist and college president, had a penchant for finding the place where the engine turned on in other people's books. He read a novel of mine called The Child Keeper in manuscript, and immediately pointed to the place where the engine started. It's here as an example of how even a slight omen can encourage the reader to keep reading. In the first two pages, we learn that Roger Maxwell, a banker content with wife and children, has just received a promotion that enables him to buy a new house for his family. Friends put him on to the best real estate agent in the vicinity of Chappaqua and Pleasantville, a man named Stickney. On the phone, Stickney asks a few questions. Note how innocuous they seem. "Children?" asked Stickney. "4," said Roger. "One's away at college, but we've got to keep a room for him." "Guests?" "Sometimes, especially the children. They like to have their friends sleep over." And so it goes for a few more lines, while Stickney flips through his cards listing houses that might be suitable. Then he says, "Could you come up Sunday, say at 2? "Of course." "You'll bring the children?" "Yes." Stickney was pleased. Children were part of his strategy. That last sentence, according to Josiah Bunting, was when the engine turned on. As it happens, we soon learn that Stickney intends to sell Maxwell a house that's a haven for children. It has a 2-story room with bunk beds made of canoes and a forest of stuffed animals. The novel, published in 1975, long before child abuse became a front-burner topic, was about its opposite, parent abuse. We see evidence of that in the most ordinary context, bit by bit, until the story explodes. The only hint of the theme is in the epigraph that appears before page 1. Epigraphs, please note, can be useful omens. I turned a saying of Oscar Wilde's on its head. "Parents begin by loving their children. As they grow older, they judge them. Sometimes they forgive them."